At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more. Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills. Accelerate your team's impact and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning into Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 17, Episode 10. This week, we got to be a fly on the wall for Bob and Dr. Nikki Jackson's discussion on our case against Chris Bynum and ultimately what led police to him. It was a great conversation and great to hear from Dr. Jackson again. Today, the crew is all here, and Bob, Janet, and I are here to discuss all your listener questions. But before we get into that, do we have any housekeeping?
I have something that I want to talk, and then I think Janet has a recommendation. But the big one, in case you've been living under a rock and are unaware, if you're watching this live stream on live on Wednesday, then it's tomorrow. If you're listening to it on Friday, it was yesterday. But Thursday of this week, episode 5 of the HBO documentary about Adnan's case, the one that Robbie Chowdhury helped produce, episode 5, the final episode, is airing. So that if you're listening to this Friday, it's out now. Right, we haven't seen it yet. Hasn't come out yet. Comes out on Thursday. But super excited about that. Just wanted to let everybody know and make sure everybody goes and gives that a watch. I can't wait to see it. I know it's been in the works for a couple of years. So super excited to see what happens with that.
Great. I'm very excited to watch that. Although I always get so nervous around Adnan stuff now because there's just like so much negativity around it that I'm like, oh, what is this going to unleash on the internets? Yeah. So I'm just going to ignore anything annoying and enjoy that they're still talking about it. I also wanted to give a shout out to Amber Hunt's podcast, What If They're Wrong? What If They're Wrong is essentially the Accused podcast, which was a phenomenal success at the time that it was released. It's had multiple seasons, and Amber and her team worked very hard while they were at the, I believe, Cincinnati Inquirer, although I don't really need to give it a shout out because ultimately what ended up happening was they pulled the funding for that podcast and then they wouldn't give the rights to the podcast to Amber and company, even though they were entirely the reason it existed at all. So yeah. The reason I say all this is because they are still following the case of Elwood Jones, who was a wrongfully convicted person and is currently out, but is another wrongful conviction conversation to be had that's ongoing. There are things happening with the case. I'm sure they will also pursue other cases as they go. But because it's called What If They're Wrong now and is no longer on the Accused feed, I'm worried that people won't find it as readily. So please go listen, check it out. You can also support Grab Bag Collab, which is a little network that sounds diminutive. I don't mean it that way. It's just a wonderful little community of really great shows that Amber and her friends and team put together that supports lots of new shows, gives them a place to kind of come alive. So overall, she's just doing such great work. And if you are a fan of the Accused podcast, and even if you aren't familiar with it, please check out What If They're Wrong. It's very much in the wheelhouse of what Truth and Justice listeners are interested in and all about.
Yeah, and I haven't heard it yet, but I love Amber and all of her work. And just to be clear, like this is not an ad swap or a paid advertising.
No. It's just a wanting to support fellow creator situation.
Yep. And also something in the chat I did not mention, so we want to know, was the name of the documentary. The docuseries is called The Case Against Adnan Syed. It's on HBO. I assume that if there's such a thing as HBO, the TV channel anymore, but HBO Max, the streaming service. So the first, it was, gosh, what's it been? three, four, 5 years ago, they released the first four parts of it.
Yeah.
And then I think they were all like 1 hour parts. And then now on the 18th, on Thursday, the 18th, part five comes out. I just looked up online. The part five is called The Tree Grew. But yeah, if you go to HBO Max and look up The Case Against Adnan Syed, you'll be able to check that out. And the first four episodes, it's I think one of the best docuseries that are out there on any case.
Yeah.
And I include my own in that underneath what how good of a job they did on this one. So yeah, check that out. Check out Amber's show. And that being said, we're going to move into Chris Bynum's case. This is I'm excited to make this pivot. I've learned a lot over the last couple of weeks because I've purposely tried to like stay away from a lot of the case against Chris until I felt like I had a better understanding of these crime scenes. You know, kind of what I had been told. I had read through the statements months and months ago, and you know, it seemed like from what I was told, these don't match the elements of the crime scene. So that's why I kind of just like put them aside. I'm like, well, I need to figure out what I believe happened at these crime scenes before I make that determination. I don't want that to warp my interpretation of where things were at. So that's why I decided to do this now. I figured like we've got more work to do on the crime scenes, but I feel like I've got a pretty good grip on them. We've got a lot of the facts. We know what a lot of the witnesses had said. And so Dr. Jackson did a great job of bridging that gap from us to get us to where we're going this Sunday when we're going to start hearing about his arrest and those actual statements. What were you guys' takeaways from the episode?
I loved hearing from Dr. Jackson. She's so well-spoken and so fun to listen to. Like, I love the way she explained a lot of it. The one piece of shade I'm going to throw in this episode, I had to listen twice because I thought I missed what led them to Chris Bynum. You guys said it multiple times in the episode.
It's quick. Yeah.
But I literally was like, I listened to it the first time through and I went, well, what the hell? Like, how'd they get to him? I still don't understand how they got to him. And then listened to it again just to realize it's that one anonymous tip.
Alleged. Anonymous tip, right.
And that's really it. That's really it, is that they got, I mean, whether or not the tip came in, that is the reason that is presented as, like,
and
this
so it
is
gets
how
worse
we got
than
there.
That, I'm going to spoil a little bit about what you're going to hear on Sunday. It's only a small piece, though, because I think I don't want us to have a conversation that I know is inaccurate. It's even worse than Dr. Jackson remembered. We talked more about it later, and actually we dug it up. So let me back up a little bit. So in the beginning, we started doing research. I had Erica, you know, she's our main researcher and starts breaking things down and outlining them for me. You know, I had asked her on a couple of occasions, I need you to find all the documents and break down for me how Chris ended up in that interrogation room to begin with. And she went through all the documents, trial transcripts, everything. And she was like, I don't know. And so, you know, we kind of moved on to other things. And as we started circling back around our second time through, I'm like, okay, write me up another summary of how the police got to Chris. I need to understand how that investigation happened. And it was, again, she went through and she's just like, I don't know. Like, Shanita was picked up. Chris was arrested. He gave the statement. I don't know how his name came into this. So actually, when Dr. Jackson was on and she was saying that it was at trial, they mentioned this tip. I have not read through all of the transcripts, but Erica has, and Erica doesn't miss things. And so I was like, wait a minute, like how, like that, surely she would have caught that if it said that in the transcript. So I started researching, could not find it, was reading all the detective's testimonies again, started doing keyword searches, and Erica will take in like the transcripts come in volumes, like a volume is a whole day of testimony. So we have those, but then she'll also break them down by each person. So they're easier to like look up. So I went back to the original volumes from the beginning to the end, and I was like keyword searching the word tip. I couldn't find it anywhere. Reached out to Nikki and was like, where, like, help me out here, because like I can't find it. I need to find it and quote it, and I can't find it. And you know, she says, you know, it's been a long time since I read the transcripts. Let me ask you guys, remember Timmy from when Timmy was on the show back in like January or December with Dr. Jackson? And she's like, oh, it's in the transcript. It's not in the trial transcript. It was in a PCR hearing, post-conviction in an appeal hearing. So first of all, Erica didn't miss anything. It literally, there is no mention of that tip in the police reports. There's not a report written for it. Not at the trial. Nowhere. It was never mentioned anywhere until years after the trial, once they started putting the investigation under scrutiny. And that's when Detective Moxley says, and I still haven't even seen it in the PCR script or transcripts yet, because I'm still on the trial piece of it. Moxley says, oh yeah, we got an anonymous tip that said it was these three guys and Chris was one of them. Because what's being called into question is, why were you after this guy?
Right.
Right.
Like it doesn't, even if what Willie told you that there was a Chris, like, why does that mean Cleveland Bynum, whose middle name is Chris?
Yeah.
Like, how does that happen? And you're like, oh, well, the anonymous tip named him. Well, what anonymous tip?
Well, that was definitely, as you can imagine, something that stuck out in starkly for me. And then I was pleased to see that the same was true for a bunch of listeners on the Facebook post, which is, that's what Nikki said. Dr. Jackson said that they named three people and that Chris Bynum was mm-hmm. one of those names. So as you can imagine, Solomon and Sarah and several others essentially said, you know, so wait, Solomon thought maybe there were three people who were convicted, but my understanding is that only one person was convicted. So now there's this nebulous question about who are the other two names and what happened with them and what was their connection. So that opened up a whole new can of worms for people about, like, okay, well, what about these other two people? What's going on there?
Yeah. So to just give you a heads up, what's coming Sunday is I'm starting to walk you through the chronology of what happened once Chris got arrested or once he got brought in, right? So his statement, and then there's another individual that gives a statement and who's one of the people that were named in the tip. So all those questions will get answered on Sunday. At least we're starting to get into those details. But, you know, the short answer is, you know, it's they bring Chris in and he signs a statement. And where he, in his statement, he says that it was him and these two guys that were allegedly part of this tip. They bring one of those guys in. He's like, no, it wasn't me. And they're like, cool, you can go. And just convicted Chris. That's the whole story. Like, that's it. Like, he just walked away, didn't worry about anybody else, and just convicted. And
what about the third guy?
Yeah, it's all going to be answered. Sorry. But despite the fact that you have this alleged tip that names three guys, even if you go beyond that, what we have from Larry, which to me is like the best source document we have, is what Larry told the officers at the scene that night, where he said, I heard two voices. They sounded like black men. I didn't recognize them. That was it. So even with that, that's two people. They convicted one and closed the case and never looked back 24 years ago.
Mm. Well, no, I was going to ask, this was not me throwing shade, nor do I feel like what you said, Zach, was necessarily would be construed as throwing shade. But I think the thing that you had brought up before, and then you and Dr. Jackson talked about it as well. And on one level, I couldn't agree more with you. I think empirically, this idea of having Larry say the name Chris Bynum over and over again, and then specifically asking, and do you see Chris Bynum here in the court, rather than saying, and do you see the person that was, you believe was in the house that night? I think that is very sneaky. And I think, like, just looking at it from, again, yeah, sort of like a strategy, that it seems very slippery. I guess my question to you is, because they had already gotten Larry to believe it anyway, and Larry said Chris Bynum's name over and over again in his testimony, do you really think it would have changed anything if they had used the verbiage, and do you see the man responsible for this in the courtroom today? Do you think it would have changed anything? Do you think Larry would have said something different, or do you think he would have said, yeah, he's right there, that's Chris Bynum, the guy I kept saying was there?
Well, if you read the transcript for the trial, what you'll see is, and again, you don't take this, you have to really pay attention, especially because we read like his supposed interview transcript, right? And in that interview transcript, he sees him, he recognizes him and all this stuff, right? But if you read his trial transcript, he doesn't say that he never says, unless I'm mistaken, that he saw Chris Bynum.
Right.
He only testifies that he heard him.
Right.
And so that would have been perhaps he may have just went with it, but that would have created, I think, some serious problems on cross-examination, if he said, nope, I didn't see, I just heard the voices. I recognized his voice. I knew it's Chris Bynum. It's Chris Bynum's voice. I heard his voice. Never said he saw him at all. And then if they're like, do you recognize the person you saw? Well, he didn't say he saw anybody.
Lowe's early Black Friday deals are going fast. Don't miss up to 50% off select major appliances. Plus, up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. And with Christmas around the corner, you're going to need more string lights, right? Save $4 on GE LED 100-count string lights, now just $5.98. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 12/3. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here! Right now, score up to 80% off everything home. These are our best deals of the year. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday sale now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
So, but it's the whole thing is, it was just such sleight of hand because like I had to go back after that interview with Nikki and go reread that transcript because like in my mind, I read it and he said that he saw Chris and he identified Chris as the person there. And she said then, and sure enough, that's not what he said at all.
Yeah.
Said he heard Chris Bynum, Chris Bynum, Chris Bynum, Chris Bynum, Chris Bynum, Chris Bynum. And then she said, do you recognize Chris Bynum? And he's like, yeah, he's right there.
Right.
Wearing the tuxedo.
So I want to piggyback off that question with Larry, and you and Dr. Jackson talked about this. The idea that the police or the investigators told Larry that Chris had confessed. And I know that we hear that in the Larry Brooks episode during his appeals deposition, that he says that, but do we have any actual timeline of when he was told? Because that's it's concerning to me. But also, we need to know when he was told. If he was really told between those two initial interviews, or if he was told at a later point.
Mm-hmm. He said in his deposition that they told him that they went and picked him up at his grandma's house, and then when they took him to the station to give his statement, which was on the 17th, that they told him before he gave that statement that Chris Bynum had already confessed. That's what he said in his deposition, and I believe it's in his affidavit as well.
Okay, so I just didn't remember that. I remember him talking about that in the deposition. I didn't remember when he said it. I thought the way I remembered it was he said it before they went to trial.
Before they went to trial is when he couldn't remember who, he didn't know who it was, but at trial, he said, is when somebody, before he went out to go testify, that somebody grabbed him and showed him where Chris Bynum was in the courtroom. So that when they asked him to identify him, he would know where he was and how to point him out.
Okay, well, thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah, but he said they told him that Chris had already confessed to it before he gave his initial statement. Because in that deposition, he's reading his initial statement at that point, and that's when he's like, "I didn't say this. I would have never said this." And then they're like, "Well, why were you so sure it was Chris Bynum when you gave this interview?" And he said, "It's because they told me it was." They told me he not only that it was him, but they told me that he had already confessed to it.
And we know in the timeline that interview came before they even talked to Chris.
Yeah. Yeah. That interview was on the morning of the 17th and they interviewed Chris on the 18th.
Shit.
They not only before they interviewed him, they hadn't found him. They were looking for him.
God, I wonder if that do you allow for the possibility that some of that memory might be inaccurate just in terms of how, like, the timeline, the chronology of that? I'm just wondering.
Because one thing that I brought up with Nikki was one thing that is odd about his interview. Now, she said there's evidence indicating that it was the right time, that, you know, what he was wearing, he was still wearing his pajamas, he was doing the stuff, you know, that it was that morning for sure. He wasn't sure on the time, but none of the times and dates are documented on his interview.
Like,
we don't know when that transcript came from.
Which,
but he said that's
not good.
He said it was that morning.
I mean, right, you know, so, date and time on an interview transcript? That's crazy.
No.
That's crazy.
There and the other ones, like Chris's, has an exact, it's time stamped at the top of every page. Which is another issue that I talk about in this episode. There's some interesting things with the timestamps on that as well. Yeah, the whole thing is, it seems to me that for whatever reason, maybe it was, maybe there was a tip, I don't know, but who knows what it was, because Chris was at like the VFW hall that I mentioned before, though, like we know where Chris was at that evening. Mm-hmm. Chris was at the, there's many witnesses that he was at the VFW hall playing pool with one of the other guys that was named in that alleged tip. So for all I know, here's kind of, this is just a hypothetical, as I'm trying to piece together how this would have happened, how they would have got to Chris. There had to be some reason, because Chris isn't the usual suspect guy, right? So he's not a guy that is always on their radar and he's mixed up in every violent crime. There's nothing like that with Chris. So why do they narrow in on him? This is what I think is a possibility of what could have happened. I'm not even saying this is what I think happened, because we still need more information. Based on what we know, I think there was a Chris. I think that a call to Willie did happen from AMP, and he mentioned the name Chris. So I think the police have that information, right? So there's some Chris that had an argument with him that night. I don't think that, you know, whether all the details of that call happened or not, I don't know. And I don't even know if it happened, but let's just say that call did happen. So they have in their mind there's a Chris. Then they get some anonymous tip, maybe from somebody that says, hey, I saw Chris Bynum and this other guy at the VFW that night. They had an argument and one of them had a gun. And so then they're like, okay, so we get this tip that there's a Chris Bynum involved. We also have this Willie guy, and that there was a gun connected. And now we got Willie saying that he said there was a Chris there. So maybe that's our Chris. And I think maybe it's just as simple as the cops, they don't give, it's very clear they didn't give a shit about these victims from the way they treated Tasha to everything else, right? It's like, okay, we got this piece of evidence that says Chris. We got a tip that says Chris Bynum. Let's now Larry comes in. We got an impressionable 12-year-old kid. We can get him to say whatever we want. Ugh. Let's just tell him, hey, Chris Bynum came in and confessed. So we know it's him. Now tell us what you saw and just say it was Chris Bynum. So he says, all right, it was Chris. Can't remember his last name, but his name's Chris B something, whatever. Right. So now by the time they actually get Chris, now they already have this evidence stacked up against him. Ooh. They've got a tip that said Chris Bynum. They got Willie saying he talked to a Chris, and Larry saying that it was Chris some with last name B. And they've got all this that they can lean on Chris Bynum with when he comes in. And so it was just a matter of, I don't think it was like I don't think there's a situation where they just like pulled a name out of a hat. Let's just grab some guy named Chris and get this over with.
Yeah.
I think that there had to be something that connected those dots to give them enough to be like, okay, we can fake a case against this guy. Hmm. We can make a case against this guy, right?
What so blows
I
my
think
mind,
it could
though,
be something like that.
Uh-huh.
What blows my mind is how short of time this all happened in.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm getting the dates wrong, right? The murders occurred the night of the 16th, morning of the 17th.
Correct.
Right, overnight. By the time they bring Larry in, the morning of the 17th, so hours later, they've already got an anonymous tip, supposedly, that Chris has done this. So how did information get out that quickly? That's, if they really received a tip, they received a tip within this 4-hour span that they haven't really even looked at the scene yet. Like, how are people finding that? It doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. Yeah. How could that even happen?
Yeah, I agree. Like, none of it, and just the idea of, you have 5 murders spread across 2 crimes. Keep in mind, they hadn't even found Liz and Sheila yet. When Larry went in and gave his statement, they didn't even know that there was 2 more murders at that point.
This is so
much less
wild
that they were connected.
And also, of course, we don't know what as you and Dr. Jackson are talking about, what the substance of his conversation with the police was. Like, if I'm remembering correctly, she says, I don't even like to call them confessions. He made incriminating statements. So I'm also, you know, dying to know exactly how all of that went down, as I'm sure everyone else is.
Yeah. And you will, I promise you, over the next 2 weeks, you're getting those answers, how that went down, how all that went down. But yeah, so, but you think about 5 homicides, 2 locations, Before they even find the second crime scene and the second two victims, they're already telling Larry they know who did it. Compare that to, you know, last week there was an assassination that had every state, local, county, and federal law enforcement agency involved. Video cameras everywhere in 2025, and it took them 27 hours to locate locate a person and get them in custody. And it took them about 24 hours to figure out who he was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because if you remember how that played out last week, they gave a press conference the next day and said, we have images of him. We're trying to use software to figure out who he is. Once they couldn't do that, then they put the image out to the public, and then he was caught. So, but think about how long, with all those resources in 2025, with all the cameras and all this stuff that's going on, that's out there, how long it took them to solve that. Well, to find the person and arrest somebody, compared to how long it took to solve this quintuple homicide by a local police department.
Well, just to further complicate that, I guess I could be wrong about this, but my understanding of this current thing that happened was that that person came forward. So it wasn't even that the authorities found the person. The person, because of a family member and family friend, like they came forward to say it was me or it was him. This is
something like that. Yeah, yeah. He was turned in or whatever.
So it wasn't even like,
yeah.
Like it took even the participation of the alleged person involved.
Yeah.
So, which is weird, because in a weird way that comes around full circle again, which is like, well, we could say the same thing about Chris Bynum. Like, look, you know, we happened to hear something, and then he confessed. So done and dusted. Like, we're good. Close it up.
Yeah. Yeah. It just seems the idea that without any cameras or witnesses or anything to the, because I also remember that there's no video of him, there's no pictures of him, there's not even any witnesses that saw him, right? Because Larry didn't see the offenders, and still 24 hours later they've got him in custody.
Well, and we hear from Dr. Jackson about, you know, this girlfriend who may or may not have been kind of held or threatened in some way, which is just one of those tactics that is so just devastating to hear about, if that indeed is the case. Like the idea of threatening a loved one above and beyond, like that's another thing that people are like, oh, I would never say. Well, now imagine it's not even you that is being threatened. Now imagine that it's someone in your life that you feel is vulnerable, yeah, in some way, that you love very deeply, that you would never want anything bad to happen to. And now they've turned the spotlight off of, in terms of a threat, off of you going to prison. And now they're saying like, well, we're going to ruin this other person's life. Like that's
who's also the mother of
your child. Oh, man. Another really great level of like, well, maybe you can't understand that you would say you were complicit in something if it was just your future you're looking at, but what if it was the person who meant everything to you at the time, you know?
I always go back to, in one of my interviews with Jim Tranum, the false confession expert, he always says, everybody says, I would never, I would never, I would never. And he says something to the extent, I'm paraphrasing, there is a gun that could be held to anyone's head and get them to confess. It's a different gun for everybody.
Yeah.
But don't think there isn't something that could get you to do it.
And the Reed Technique's job is figuring out what that is rather than figuring out whether you're guilty.
Right.
Oh, yeah. That's so scary.
And I'll just tell you, like these statements, like they're not even, she's right to say they're not confessions.
Hmm.
Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pre-game podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Well, let's go to Christina, who says, do you think it's possible that the police department kept the vehicles under the guise of civil asset forfeiture and its departmental strategy to fund efforts? Do you know what that's a reference to as far as like what happened to the actual?
Yeah. So, yeah, car. Basically yeah. Saying like there wasn't anything nefarious regarding the case as to why they kept the cars, but maybe they just kept them because if they can. It's a civil average.
A seizure, yeah.
Can't even. That's what I was looking for. Mm-hmm. They were going to take them and then they sell them in auction to raise money for the police department. It's. I mean, who knows? Like, none of this makes any sense.
Yeah.
Well, none in my opinion, the car at the ball field crime scene not being released doesn't surprise me. That seems like a piece of evidence, which wouldn't be released.
Well, let me give you another example of that. Haman Lee's car. Okay. The state's theory that they went to trial with mm-hmm. was that she was murdered in her car. The police took it. They took it into custody. They processed it. They pulled all the evidence out of it. They photographed it. And then they released it back to the family.
Okay.
You know, so it's not like it's in this case, they didn't present any evidence from in the car. And they've got like some fingerprints from it. And this is also we'll get into when we get into forensics later, but like they got fingerprints from it. They tested them against the victims and Chris. There's unknown fingerprints, but they don't match Chris. So they just didn't bring them up at trial, right? So they don't use any of that stuff from the car. So they use nothing from the car. So I don't see why they don't release it if they're not going to use it. And especially, I've seen cases where they'll take things like that and they'll hold them until the trial's over. And then if they used the car as an exhibit and as evidence somehow, then that remains in state custody because it's part of the record. But that wasn't the case here. So by the time the trial's over, certainly there's no reason for them to continue to keep that car.
Hmm. Okay.
Well, speaking of cars, Patricia says, do we know how the perpetrators left that ball field after the murders? We know that one car was left behind. Patricia says, was there another vehicle involved or could they possibly... And then in parentheses, unlikely, says Patricia, walked. Could they possibly have walked? Do you have any theories about how that happened?
We don't know right now. And that's one of the episodes I said we're going to circle back to the crime scenes at some point. I want to do a detailed analysis of that crime scene. I've mentioned him a couple times. Listener Colin, who has done a really good job of helping like break down some very specific elements of the crime scene and piece things together. And that's what I want to see. My thoughts are... that there were two vehicles, they moved the one, and then they drove away with the other one. I have some reasons for thinking that, but it's just really hypothesis. But it's also possible that they rode there with the two victims and then walked and left. There is enough. One thing I know is there is enough time. Presuming the two crime scenes are connected, and we know that one, we're fairly certain that one happened first, based on the time that the neighbor there heard the gunshots, there is enough time for that crime to have been committed and then someone to have left and walked and got to the house on 10th Avenue in time to commit those murders as well.
Hmm.
It's tight, though. I mean, it's tight. Like, they would have to, as soon as the bodies were you know, were tossed into the woods and the car was parked, they would have to be hoofing it immediately.
But it is possible.
It's possible based on like Google Map walk times.
Well, I'm sure we're all hoping that maybe we can help get a little more clarity with that. But yeah, that's and then to Tool Girl's point in the chat, how much could they make off the sale of the car at the ball field, the one that had to be started with a screwdriver? Fair point.
Yeah, I wouldn't think much.
Fair point.
Like it's not it, that wasn't, you know, it wasn't a Maserati.
Yeah.
You know, it was an older model, basic sedan.
Yeah. Patricia also says, well, I'm going to read, I sort of went backwards because of the context of what we were just talking about and how it led into the question about the car. But Patricia says, first, a big thank you to Dr. Jackson for participating in this week's episode. She struck me as extremely smart, empathetic, and humble. My questions are, so we talked about the car one. The other is, was Liz friends with both Willie and Amp? Willie claimed he was friends with Liz, but another time said Amp was her friend.
That's a good question, and it's a question I may pose to Tasha. I might text her and ask her that one. I'm not sure because I noticed the same thing. Like in one version of Willie's story, he's friends with her and talked to her earlier. Then another version, she's just friends with Amp. So I don't know. I mean, we know from what Liz said, she was very good friends with Amp. Never heard anything about Willie.
Okay, Carl says might have missed this, but will you be talking to Chris this season?
I think so. So there's possibly some litigation coming and some wheels that are turning right now, and that's always a tricky time to talk to somebody when that's going on. I think I'll be able to speak with him, but it may be one of those situations where I can talk to him and have him on, because I want you guys to meet. I have not met Chris, and as you guys know, in you know the last five or so seasons, I've tried to make it a point to not get like super close and friendly with the people that we're talking about, because I don't want it influencing, or even the implication of it influencing the work that I'm doing on the case. I'm trying to remain unbiased, but I would like to speak with Chris, and I would like you guys to hear from Chris, but it would probably be a lot of like, what has this been like for him? And not because of the fact that, I mean, obviously he's still trying to get out of prison. He's still trying to file appeals. And I don't know this, but I would assume that his attorneys would tell him, don't talk about the case, because anything he says about the case is something that could be used in trial or in his appeals.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you would bring up his attorneys, because Linwood says, did I hear correctly that Chris's lawyer during the trial had dementia? If so, I'm flabbergasted by their refusal to step away from a case where there are five murders.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that. I have not investigated that, but that's one of the things that, you know, I plan to do, and it's on my docket for an episode at some point to really investigate into Chris's attorney to see, you know, what happened with other cases around this time. Is it well documented that he did have dementia? Because at this point, all I know is what people have told me about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think for many of us who are familiar with Adnan's case and the murder of Haman Lee, that when we hear something about a attorney that is not just, you know, ineffective assistance level, but is medically, psychologically, potentially very, very compromised, it's very frightening. It's sort of frightening on a different level. And it's very tragic.
It is.
For everyone.
It is. And when I read the transcripts, like, they don't read to me like somebody that's just clueless at all. Gradick does, like, he takes some pretty good swings here and there in the cross-examinations, but it does read to me. But the thing is, I don't think that's necessarily necessary for, I don't think that there has to be some like underlying issue for a defense attorney to not have a great grip and understanding of all the details of the case because of the workload they're put under. Because we've also seen the same thing with very good attorneys who just, you know, it's for me, you know, I'm investigating this one case every day, 8 hours a day, for months and months and months, and learning every little intimate detail about it. So when I do that and I'm reading testimony and it's getting into the cross-examination, I'm like, hit him with this, hit him with this, hit him with this, hit him with this. And they're not doing it. I don't think that necessarily means they have to have something inherently wrong. I think that that's a common problem. It's almost an epidemic, particularly in public defenders, not because they're inferior attorneys, but because their caseload is so big, they don't have the time and resources to dig that deep into cases.
Yeah.
But certainly when you read these transcripts, if you've read any of the ones we posted on the website, you'll see where like he's making attempts at cross-examination, but in my opinion, he's missing big opportunities. This case seems winnable to me. That's what's frustrating when I'm reading it. Like the evidence against Chris Bynum is so weak. Like it should be winnable, right? You should be able to. But then there was also some hide the ball with some documents, like the Moxley report and the Dame, you know, things like that. Dame didn't testify, things, you know, of that nature. But like you should have been able to impeach Larry Brooks pretty well. And again, I always want to stress that, you know, I'm not disparaging Larry at all. It's a 12-year-old little boy.
Yeah.
That's being manipulated into this situation, but he's a 12-year-old little boy. As much as the prosecution could manipulate him, certainly with a little bit of pressure, he could be impeached, and that you could get that story to fall apart to what the original story really was. I feel like pretty easily, like many, you know, a good cross examination by a good defense attorney, many, you know, adults struggle under those circumstances. That's why. It's very rare to have a defendant testify in their own defense, because lawyers know under cross-examination, this could go real bad, right? This is a 12-year-old boy. Like, how are you not able to understand too? There's also, I'm sure strategically, there's a concern of, you know, do I want to beat up this 12-year-old kid in front of the jury?
Right.
Or is that going to make it worse?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the, those are the sort of things that you're constantly weighing as you are figuring out what you need to use and what you can't use and, you know, what maybe you shouldn't use. But I agree with you that if there's probably a way to do that, I guess I'm just still not totally sure. What kind of a handle the attorney had on the case and what kind of a handle they had on how some of these things happened chronologically and where to be able to pick that apart to.
Yeah.
Be exacting
such huge
and very
holes.
Careful about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And with Larry, like as I was saying it, Sue in the chat just put the defense attorney would look like a monster if they're like impeaching Larry. But I'm always looking at these and I understand it's Monday morning quarterbacking and it's in hindsight. But I always try to think like how, and of course I'm not an attorney, but I always look at like, how could I handle it? Like, how could I gently be talking to him? Like, you know, we appreciate here. We know this is, you know, we're sorry that you lost your parents. Or you lost your mom and your family. And we're just trying to really understand what happened so we get the right person here. And then and ask them, like, you know, we noticed that when you told the police the first time, you said that you didn't hear anything, but now you're saying that Chris Bynum is. Can you explain to me how that changed from not seeing anyone?
Mm.
And I would want to, I mean, for me, I would want to lead it into the question, like, is there any chance, did anybody ever suggest to you?
Yeah.
This name, Chris Bynum?
Sure.
Right? Like, these are you know, to me, like, those would be, as a jury, I would be, me personally, like, I would be compelled by that, but you would have to be very careful and very gentle, and it's a big risk. But to me, like, when you heard Larry's direct examination and how devastating that was to Chris's case, I feel like, as a defense attorney, you should have been like, I've got to do something. I need to bring my egg. Somehow I've got to undo this damage without creating more damage by, you know, vilifying a 12-year-old.
And sorry, maybe I missed this, but did he, and you may have said this, and I'm behind in reading docs, did he cross-examine him at all? Or is it just like, okay, no questions, Your Honor?
He did, but it was pretty light cross-examination.
Okay. 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 So Christie says, is it possible for someone to do a FOIA request with the fire department to see if there was an actual fire? And Valeria said, yeah. Adding to this, as I wanted to ask something similar, i.e. what efforts have been made to see if any evidence was actually destroyed or not? We've heard so many times about evidence that magically reappears.
So this is a weird case for me because the case has been worked on for so long by so many, you know, great law firms that have been working on it in, as well as Nikki and her center that have worked on it for so long, that they've filed so many FOIA requests. They've met with the attorneys, they've met with the prosecutors, they've inspected the files, they have everything that's available to them. So like, this is one case where I haven't filed any FOIA requests. I do plan on filing some at some point when I have a really good grip on what I think specific, because this isn't one where I'm going to say, I want a FOIA request for the entire case file, which will cost thousands of dollars. It always does when we get these files, because we have the case file already, you know, like we have all this information already. So I need to know, I need to get to a point where I'm like, okay, here's a document. Here's a, what I like to do in situations like this is, here is a report that references this other report, and that other report is not in the file, but I know it exists because of this. So I'm requesting this report, and then I'll provide that evidence with it, right? As far as the, if anything was, if there were, if evidence was actually destroyed in a fire, I don't know if that's been looked into, but that's a good option, is to just, might be worth filing a FOIA request. You know, I hadn't really thought about it in this case, but maybe like Marl Levert had in the West Memphis 3 case, as mentioned. Can you tell us when there were fires at the police department? You know, did one happen? Just so we'll know, we'll have that kind of in the back of our mind. And part of it is too, is I think this is far less of a case. So like in Jody's case, there were obvious in season 15, right? There was obvious places like you've, like this happened. Like, You went and interviewed the LaShawn at the restaurant that morning. We know that from him. Where's the report on that, right? There's all these things that we know that are missing from the file. In this case, my impression so far is that it's not that there's a whole lot of stuff missing, because I don't think they investigated.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because that's what you're looking for, is what document did you find that you're hiding from us? And it's like, I don't think they did an investigation enough to find out, right? Mm. So, you know, did they go looking for people who had seen Liz and Sheila that night? Did they go to the liquor stores and try to find out where she was? Did they pull surveillance? Those are the types of things you'd be looking for. But I don't think they even did it. I really don't. I don't think they gave a shit.
Yeah. Was that something that we were talking about on this pod? This is a really my true love of wrongful conviction podcasts showing right now. Revealing itself, but I can't remember if it was on this podcast recently or if I was listening to it, for example, on the new Undisclosed season or maybe even somewhere else. But this idea of like, it's harder. It can be harder when a case is so thin.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you don't have much that you can even point to, which sounds absurd. It's like, you would think that the thinner the case, the easier it would be to prove. But if it's just sort of nebulous and there's just not a lot to point to in any direction anywhere, it's actually harder because you can't find those gems that you can really hold up and circle and say, look at this, look at this. Instead, it's just like, there was never a case. There was never a case. It's like judges don't want to hear that. Yeah. It's like judges are like, well, there clearly was a case because the jury found them guilty. Bye.
Yeah, I think you're probably referring to conversations that I've had recently on our show about that. It's like Jesse Eldridge's case is a perfect example.
That's
even
right.
Sandy Melgar's doing
it. Thank you.
Yeah, but yeah, because the problem is the burden of proof shifts. It goes from, you know, at trial how they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to you have to prove with a preponderance of the evidence, and the burden is all on the defense, and you can't just negatively, you know, prove that the state's case isn't accurate. Like you have to provide positive evidence that says, this is how we know he's innocent. And it's so much more of a hurdle to get over. And then when you have no evidence to work with, you know, like think about like Pinyon Pines, like we're going through, when were they at the gas station? When, look at the cell phone towers, what can we piece together? Where can we find, who did the police talk to? And you can find all these different angles. In this, you have victims that were traveling around that night that obviously came into contact with other people somewhere, but we don't have any investigation in that direction to pick apart.
Right.
We don't have names to interview. We are going to have some based on some other information that we'll be talking about later, but it's going to be kind of a stretch. But yeah, it makes it very difficult. It makes it very difficult from an appeals perspective to overturn a case that was built on air.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and especially, I mean, if they were already looking at Chris Bynum hours into this, they didn't have to look elsewhere. And I say they didn't have to. I mean, they should have, but in theory, they've got their guy. They're just going to find evidence that proves him guilty. So they're not looking at other things.
Yeah, and that's the state narrative, right? Well, I mean, 24 hours later, he confessed. Why am I going to waste time and resources figuring out where the victims went when he already told us what happened?
Right.
I don't know, maybe because you've already acknowledged that more than one person was involved and you should want to hold those people accountable. And if there is no way that that works, then it doesn't, then something's very wrong.
Yeah.
With this picture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's all the questions I have from the post. Obviously, very, very, very interested in what is coming this upcoming week and the upcoming weeks as we get further into this police interrogation, arrest, all of that kind of stuff. I'm kind of dreading it, even though I can't wait for it.
Yeah. So, and I'm doing something that I've never done before, in the fact that I went into this week thinking I'm gonna break down these statements like I normally do, right? And what I decided to do, because they're pretty short, they're, you know, like the, like Chris's initial statement, the transcript is 12 pages long. And so instead, what I'm doing is I'm reading it so you can just hear it, the entire thing, word for word. So you're going to get to hear in like what would be kind of real time, how the conversation happened. And also, instead of going Chris's first interview, Chris's second interview, what you're going to hear this week is Chris's first statement where he implicates someone else. And then I'm leaving them in chronological order. Then the second half of that episode is that person's statement.
Oh.
And then next week, we're going to get into then what Chris said when he came back after that happened and changed it to his final version of it. So that's why I said over the next 2 weeks. So you're going to hear statement one this week, the statement from another suspect, and then that's going to lead us into next week where we get into Chris's second statement, and we're going to get into some of his post-conviction transcripts, what he testified to, where we can get to hear kind of in his own words what happened in that period of time.
Wait a minute. I'm so sorry. I'm just going to throw this in at the end. Something about what you just said just reminded me that you had Amanda Knox on right before we started this case. And just something about what you just said made me think exactly of her situation. And I thought, oh, wait a minute. So he implicated someone else. Uh-oh. Okay. All right. Okay. I'm very interested.
And we'll leave it
at that. Yes, indeed.
Well, love you guys. And we'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kate Wood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.